It is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker this afternoon. He comes to us with most impressive credentials and as one who is uniquely qualified to explain the appeal of American evangelicalism. After receiving his PhD a few blocks from here at Washington University in 1974, he went on to work as a postdoctoral fellow at the Johns Hopkins University in 1974 and 75, and then as a Charles Warren Fellow at Harvard University from 1977 to 78. Since then, he has served in a variety of capacities at the University of Notre Dame, currently as Vice President for Graduate Studies and Research. In the last decade, our speaker has authored innumerable articles and books in the area of American Christianity, including The Sacred Cause of Liberty, Republican Thought and the Millennium in Revolutionary New England. He co-edited with Mark Knoll The Bible in the American Experience and co-edited with Terry Stout Jonathan Edwards and the American Experience. His most recent book, The Democratization of American Christianity, published in hardback in 1989 and in paperback in 1991, has won a number of distinguished awards and honors. It was the co-winner of the 1990 John Hope Franklin Publication Prize for the best book in American Studies. It also won the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic 1989 Book Prize, as well as the Albert C. Outler Prize in Ecumenical Church History. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Nathan Hatch.
Thank you, Chuck. It's a distinct honor and privilege for me to be with you today. I will never forget my first encounter with Martin Luther. It was as a college junior when I attempted to do a work comparing Luther and Calvin. And I recall reading Luther's preface to the Romans. And that statement, faith is a living, daring confidence in God's grace, so sure and certain that the believer would stake his life on it 1,000 times. It was not only an intellectual experience for me, it was a deeply spiritual experience. I feel I have deep Lutheran strains within my person. I also am grateful to Concordia Seminary for the use of their library. As I was doing graduate work at Washington University, I live 3 blocks from here, and I often had occasion to use this library. It was actually much better in religious history than was the library at Washington University. I speak to you today by conviction and by heritage as a churchly evangelical. On the one hand, I've been nurtured both by Orthodox, confessional, and churchly forms of Protestantism. I'm the son of a Southern Presbyterian minister and currently a member of a Christian Reformed Church in South Bend. A tradition, I might add, that is not too unlike your own in its ethnic base, its commitment to Orthodox Protestant theology, and to parochial education. At the same time, I'm an evangelical. My father was a college-age convert in the same circle in Charlotte, North Carolina, out of which Billy Graham came. I'm a graduate of Wheaton College, and I do identify with a kind of vital piety and church renewal, which is a hallmark of American evangelicals. With one foot in each camp, then, my goal today is to address the issue of the appeal and also the limitations of a certain kind of faith orientation that we call evangelical. As a historian, I have also spent considerable time studying the history of American evangelicals, and I think this history offers considerable insight into the issues before this conference, particularly the kinds of tensions which you, as Missouri Synod Lutheran pastors, may face between the traditional rhythms and orientation of Lutheran orthodoxy and the sometimes contagious influence of evangelical forms of worship, evangelism, singing, and piety. How does one mediate between Bach chorales and contemporary and lively gospel choruses? between thoughtful homilies with a theological spine and audience-centered appeals explicitly attuned to what people want to hear. How do you negotiate between church life that is sacramentally centered and one that is pragmatic and, as they say at Willow Creek Church, seeker-friendly? Between church life organized to preserve orthodoxy and a Christian lifestyle that focuses on evangelism and conversion. The first thing I would say this afternoon is that these tensions are not new. For at least a century and a half, churches of creedal orthodoxy in America have been somewhat at odds with American evangelicals, both of whom claim the mantle of Protestant and evangelical. Let me begin with an example from the first half of the 19th century from Pennsylvania, which had to do with what happened to stately German Reformed churches. During the second decade of that century, young people in certain German Reformed communities got tired of the complicated German chorale tradition with its solemn tunes and Baroque wording. They welcomed the rousing songs and vernacular preaching of the revivalists. In this case, that of certain Methodist sects, the United Brethren in Christ, which had been founded by William Otterbein, and the evangelical association called the Albright Brethren. These groups developed a significant tradition of bush-meeting spirituals. That is, they took American gospel music, translated it to German, this kind of lively music, and presented it to these communities with great success. The success of these folk traditions among Pennsylvania Germans raised the ire of churchman Philip Schaff. It wasn't just an intellectual issue. He saw his flock being depleted. He commented in the 1840s, "There is a stamping and bouncing, jumping and falling, crying and howling, groaning and sighing, all praying in confusion, a rude singing of the most vulgar street songs. So that must be loathing to an educated man and fill the most serious Christian with painful emotions." The most devoted advocate of this revival singing and the most effective was a man named John Weinbrenner, founder of what he called the Church of God. His earlier biography noted that he possessed the very rare facility of striking the popular chord in hymnody. In 1825, Weinbrenner published the first English camp meeting songbook to appear in German, a work that went through 27 editions. This book was instrumental in the transition from English language spirituals to that of what were called Pennsylvania Dutch. In keeping with their folk singing, revivalists such as Weinbrenner were able to preach in vernacular German, unlike the college-trained Reformed counterparts who insisted on maintaining literary German. Now, Schaff denounced the upstart Weinbrenner, who dared to invent a new church, which he said existed without creed or confession. He said, "Every theological vagabond and peddler may drive his bungling trade without license or passport and sell his false ware at pleasure." What Schaff attacked was the reality of a religious demagogue, in his view. That is, someone who could rise up and tickle the ears of common folk with baseless opinions and his own private viewpoint. And Schaff inveighed against what he called the sect system, which was what he saw abounding in this American evangelical culture. This example, I think, says two things. First of all, these tensions between evangelical mores and orthodox Protestant mores have been there for some time. But secondly, that sacramental traditions often have difficulty competing with the vernacular and innovative popular evangelical style. I want to unpack that a bit this afternoon in four ways. First, by talking about the early American Republic and how this kind of evangelical style came into being, what I have called populist Christianity, or it's Christianity which is put in the vernacular. It's Christianity incarnated not in the high culture but in the popular culture. And particularly, I want to focus on that form of Christianity as a communication system. That is, the style of preaching, the style of publishing, and the style of singing that went along with it. Secondly, I want to talk about this populist pattern and how it's recurred throughout American history. It's been a dominant, if not the dominant strain, it's been a dominant subcurrent in the history of American Christianity. Finally, I want to say something about its strengths and something about its liabilities. At the time of the American Revolution, the principal churches in America were Congregational, Episcopalian, and Presbyterian. Those three churches had 55% of church adherents in America. And all had a similar structure. They all had an educated clergy. They all believed in creeds and confessions. They all believed in the sacraments as they were defined in the magisterial reformation. And they were all systems designed by an educated elite. Sermons were generally written, and since sermons were literate with a theological spine. Between the American Revolution and the Civil War, Christianity in this country was radically transformed. It became a mass enterprise. In that time, there was a tremendous growth in the American population from about 2.5 million to 20 million people. But the growth of the church was even greater. At the time of the Revolution, there were about 1,800 ministers in this country. By the time of the Civil War, there were 40,000. One per 1,500 at the time of the Revolution, clergy per people in the country, had turned to one per 500 by the time of the Civil War. Now, when you look at this, what happens is that those dominant denominations that had controlled religious life earlier completely were swept away by a different sort of Christianity. And what we see is a tremendous explosion of Baptists and Methodists. The Methodists, for instance, which at the time of the Revolution were about 2% of the population, by 1850 had over one-third of the religious adherents in this country. They had over 10,000 clergy of whatever sort. That is, by the Civil War, the Congregationalists, who at the time of the Revolution had twice as many clergy in it as anyone else, did not have one-tenth the number that the Methodists. The Baptists grew with equal strength. Between 1780 and 1810, their churches grew from 500 to 2,500. So by the time of the Civil War, two-thirds of the clergymen and religious adherents in this country were generally in the Baptist or Methodist orbit. Now, this was a profound transition and left the more sedate churches something in their wake. Although each of those traditions, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Congregationalist, remained strong, if you look at the sort of vital center of American Christianity, they had clearly lost it to these more popular groups. Let me say something about what these groups were like. Let me say five things. In my book, I call this the democratization of American Christianity. What were the assumptions behind these groups? And other groups, like the Disciples of Christ, like the Mormons, like the Adventists, all of whom had a certain style. I think we can describe it in five ways. First, they denied the age-old distinction between clergy and laity. They took the priesthood of believers one step further. All these traditions had a tremendous number of lay preachers. For instance, the Baptists and the Methodists would welcome converts and within months would turn them into preachers of one sort or another. The Mormons were the most radical. That is, they denied that a church should have a clergy at all. The Mormons, which were founded in 1830 by a commoner, Joseph Smith, they were so anti-clerical as to deny that there should be a formal clergy at all. And the Churches of Christ, founded by Alexander Campbell, they had clergy, but in a sense with very little power, and the rhetoric was very much that clergymen were beholden to their people. So the first thing is the age-old distinction between laity and clergy is done away. Secondly, these groups all associated virtue with common people rather than elites. And in this, they're very different than the Magisterial Reformation, which on the one hand talks about the priesthood of all believers, but on the other hand assumes that churches are going to be led by by educated people, educated in theological classics. These groups all identified strongly with common people, and they relished in religious experience of common people rather than trying to control it. The best experience of that, it is just in this period, from 1780 to 1830, that African-American Christianity in this country just explodes among slave and free blacks. The Methodists in 10 years were more successful in their mission efforts to African-Americans than the Episcopalians had been in a century. And the reason was is that they didn't try to get African-Americans to conform to their worship experience. What they did is preached in a common vernacular way, and then they let African-American communities express the power of their religion in their own terms. And that's the origin of the black spiritual, just in this period. So rather than suppressing popular religious expression, which often had ecstasy, in the early Republic, Methodist diaries are filled with dreams. It looks very much like early Pentecostalism. But rather than suppressing it, people like Francis Asbury encouraged, identified with that kind of popular religious expression. Another element of this in identifying with the common people is that these groups all use the biblical argument. That is, if you take Scripture itself and say, does Scripture support the elite or support the common people? It's pretty clear which side you can come out on. Who was it that Alexander Campbell would regularly say, who was it that put Christ to death? Was it the common people? No, they relished Christ. It was the rulers. It was the priests and the Pharisees and the scribes. They regularly appeal to the kind of text that says God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. They appeal to the prophets who denounced the elite and identified with the humble. Thirdly, out of this mix came the rise of populist religious leaders. People like Joseph Smith or Charles Finney, the revivalists. That is, these weren't people ordained by churches. These were people who felt called of God, in that sense they were self-ordained. Charles Finney, the powerful revivalist, he was actually ordained as a Presbyterian in a sort of an odd way. But he refused to read the he said he completely disagreed with the Westminster Confession of Faith, and he refused to go to Princeton Seminary. Similarly, people like Alexander Campbell, they turned their back on normal seminary education, and they said they were called of God. It was self-evident. And what was the vindication of that? It was the people who listened to them. It was a democratic kind of authority. So this populist kind of leadership, it was unpredictable who would arise as the next leader. Who would ordain the next evangelist? They would seem to rise out of nowhere. A fourth characteristic is that these groups were based on ties that were voluntary rather than traditional and hereditary. That is, they appeal to the human will. And the whole tradition of revivalism is one which tends to discard church tradition. It tends to regard sacramentalism for the appeal to the human will. Francis Asbury is a good example of this because English Methodism under John Wesley had been a finely tuned balance between sacramental tradition and appeal and revivalism. In America, Francis Asbury, he had little use for the Sunday service that John Wesley had sent to America. And in fact, he would rather participate in camp meetings. He tended to diminish the role of the sacraments and to exalt the role of the free will and the personal response to Christ. The final characteristic of these evangelicals that come to the fore in the early Republic is a revolt against history. That is, these people were very much of the ethos coming out of the American Revolution and the sort of Jeffersonian notion that the past is largely a heavy hand which has little to teach us. It's a kind of popular enlightenment. And out of this came the distinctive ideas, no creed but the Bible, We don't need creeds and confessions. The whole tradition of the disciples of Christ or the churches of Christ were explicit about that. Alexander Campbell said, open the Bible as if mortal man had never seen it before. Don't read it through the lens of Martin Luther or John Calvin or Jonathan Edwards. That is, open it as a text which you yourself have to interpret. This then is this impulse, this populist impulse that appeared in the early republic. Secondly, let me say how innovative this was as a communication system. That is, in this period, you have Christianity becoming mass communications. In fact, I think you could say the evangelical Christianity that comes to the fore is a style of faith that is organized around effective communications. That is its heart and soul, how well communication is carried out. In some ways, this style of Christianity is about 180 degrees from a tradition like the Missouri Synod, or one like the Christian Reformed Church, Dutch Reformed Calvinism, the church to which I belong, which tend to be internally focused, that is, designed to protect the faithful, to raise up the next generation, their deep family and ethnic connections. I say of the Christian Reformed, it's sort of an extended cousinage. Everybody knows each other, has gone to school together, the parochial system and so forth. And they tend to be very inward-looking. This kind of evangelical Christianity is just the opposite. All its antennae are pointed outward. How does this kind of faith communicate with people who don't buy into its assumptions to begin with? So in three ways, this was an innovative communication system. The first is the coming of vernacular preaching. Now, there's a long tradition of revivalists and how preaching becomes more popular. The first place to begin is probably with that of George Whitefield, the great English revivalist of the 18th century. It's a very interesting new book by Professor Harry Stout at Yale. It's a biography of Whitefield called The Divine Dramatist. What he argues is that Whitefield, his style of preaching was not principally forged in the church, but in fact came out of his experience in drama. That it was the taking of preaching outside of ecclesiastical space and into dramatic space, that is, taking it into the free market. And that his very style and his appeal to emotion was a radical change in the way preaching was done. Now, by the time you get to revivalists like Charles Finney in the middle of the 19th century, you have preaching which is very different and which is organized around its ability to communicate. Let me read to you a statement of Charles Finney, who the reason he said he did not want to go to Princeton Seminary was not theological. It was that he said going to seminary made you such a poor communicator. Finney said, look at the Methodists. Many of their ministers are unlearned in the common sense of the term. Many of them have been taken right from the shop or the farm. And yet they have gathered congregations and have pushed their way and won souls everywhere. Wherever the Methodists have gone, their plain, pointed and simple, but warm and animated mode of preaching has always gathered congregations. He's comparing them with Presbyterians. Few Presbyterian ministers have gathered so large assemblies or won so many souls. Now, what are we to be told? That we must pursue the same old formal mode of doing things amidst all these changes? As well might the North River be rolled back as the world converted under such preaching, that is, Presbyterian preaching. We must have exciting, powerful preaching, or the devil will have all the people except what the Methodists can say. And what Finney did, and somewhat successfully, is try to introduce those evangelical mores into Presbyterianism, and a major split in Presbyterianism before the North-South split, but the major new school, old school split in some ways had to do with those who wanted these evangelical mores and those like Charles Hodge and others at Princeton Seminary who resisted them. So this form of preaching is very different from traditional Reformed kind of learned discourse. It often uses humor, satire, invective. It's popular communication. And Finney also said, look to the politicians. See how well they communicate and pattern sermons after them. I definitely don't think that's a good idea. This communication revolution also involved mass print. Up until about 1800, print was still very expensive. There were very few religious magazines or journals. In 1790, there were only 14 distinct religious magazines in this country. By 1830, over 600 had been begun. And what one sees is a democratization of print. That is, you have these religious leaders, commoners, who as printing becomes cheap, as anyone can set up a printing press, they start writing. I mean, a good example is William Miller, who founded the Adventists, out of which the Seventh-day Adventists come. He was a plain farmer, unordained, and he had a view that the end of history was coming at a particular point in time. He read the book of Revelation and had a scheme by which this would happen. William Miller, in a four-year period of time, published over 4 million pieces of literature. That is, his design was to communicate this message. So everywhere he went, he preached and distributed literature. This was an age of localism in print. Paper became cheap, print was easy, and every Tom, Dick, and Harry could set up their own religious newspaper, many of them ephemeral, but nonetheless, it was that same kind of innovation in print. And even some more respectable religious publishers were right on the cutting edge of innovation. For instance, the American Bible Society and the American Tract Society in New York, they were the ones who had the first steam-powered presses and the first machine-made paper in New York City before commercial presses did, before Harper Brothers did. These religious houses were on the cutting edge of communication technology. The third area in this communications revolution has to do with music. In some ways, this was one of the more interesting things I came upon as I did research in this period. That is, the whole tradition of gospel music in America, which is so deep in American popular culture, both black and white, it really came out of this period as common people took and since refused to abide formal church music and took music into their own hands. And there's a tremendous explosion of this. And it has tremendous power. That is, you take music out of the church and you make it singable. And you have the kind of music that people identify with in their day-to-day lives. It's very, very catchy. This was not church music that required folk to worship in unfamiliar forms. That is, those fashioned by their betters, eminent musicians and poets. Instead, American gospel music reveled in the fact that the Lord had chosen earthen vessels, not silver ones. The phenomenal success of the spiritual, black and white, was proof positive that the wise held no monopoly on musical talent. Ordinary people crafted spiritual folk songs to assist the flock in weeping with the brokenhearted, shouting with the joyful, and proclaiming the good news of the gospel. The most popular Methodist songbook of this period, we know very little about its authors. They were common people. So here we see a communication system in preaching, in print, and in song that's oriented to the needs of common people. And what we see is in the period between the Revolution and the Civil War, what historian John Butler sees as the Christianizing of American culture. America is far more Christian by 1860 than it had been at the time of the American Revolution. And it moves in stark contrast to what was happening in Europe and Great Britain, where largely working-class people were being alienated from the church. In this culture, these popular forms of Christianity, unpredictable, adaptive, in fact, were penetrating popular culture very effectively. Now, my third point today is that this populist impulse is something which has been ongoing and very powerful in America. In fact, David Martin, who writes about comparative secularization, sociologist, he argues that the reason that American Christianity still remains so strong, that over half of Americans still go to church regularly, as against what has happened in Europe, is because of these kinds of powerful, popular forms of Christianity. I think there are three features of religion in America that stand out. One is the vitality of religion among common people. As you go lower in the social scale in America, the lower you go, the more religious people are. And that is not the case in Europe. Traditionally in Europe, religion, the churches are associated with higher culture. And as you move down the social scale, things become less religious. In this culture, it's just the opposite. A second feature is that we've continued to be blessed or cursed with popular religious leaders who were not ordained by churches or ecclesiastical authority, but by popular persuasion come to the fore. Who ordained Billy Sunday? No one but the people. Who ordained Billy Graham? No one, except maybe some newspaper publishers. But simply, his authority has to do with the fact that people see him as an authority. Or a Jerry Falwell, or a Pat Robertson, or other religious entrepreneurs like Bill Bright, or radio people like Jim Dobson or Chuck Swindoll, or TV people like D. James Kennedy or Oral Roberts or Robert Shuler. These people come out of nowhere. That is, it's by this democratic kind of authority that they are able to muster. They're innovative, unpredictable, and usually unecclesiastical. The third characteristic, then, of this ongoing populist impulse is that this culture has had many powerful religious movements identified with popular culture, which in some ways are unecclesiastical. That is, they don't come out of church traditions, they just sort of happen. And if one thinks of the rise of Pentecostalism, not only in this culture, but actually worldwide, it's a religious movement which does have expression in some churches, like the Assemblies of God, but it's a much more powerful expression than can be embodied in any one church. Last year, we had an interesting visitor at Notre Dame for the year. He was a Chinese scholar, who in fact, as it turns out, is a pretty high official in China with respect to policy on religion. He told me, after we were doing a reading course over the course of the year together, and near the end he actually confessed something which I had suspected all along, that in fact he was a Christian believer himself, and in also a strategic location in the government of China. But what he said their problem is, he said they can relate to churches, whether they be Lutheran, Catholic, Presbyterian, Anglican. But he said, that's not the kind of religion that's sweeping China. The kind of religion that's sweeping China is house churches. It's Christianity in unecclesiastical form. And it's just burgeoning in China, and the government there has no way to know how to deal with it. And his interest in spending the year in America was to try to understand these kinds of forms of evangelical faith. So this ongoing tradition, religion is vital among people. It has these popular religious leaders. It has these movements. And fourthly, it is organizationally pluralistic and innovative. That is, its power structure, there is no centralized power structure. It's atomistic, segmented. David Martin says this is the reason for its power. That is, you have forms of faith at every sector in the culture. It's a competitive religious market. I recall some evangelical wag saying sometime, I would consider resigning from being an evangelical, but I wouldn't know where to send my resignation. That is, there is no center of this movement. Pluralistic, innovative, atomistic. Okay, let me turn then in conclusion to some of the strengths and some of the liabilities of this tradition I've tried to describe for you. In terms of strength, let me mention four things. This evangelical impulse has been very strong in communicating the faith to others, in taking the faith to all the world, particularly to common people. That is, it's in some contrast to the traditions of the magisterial Reformation, whether they be Lutheran, Presbyterian, Anglican, whatever, which tend to be very middle class, tend to be pretty high culture. These evangelical traditions have not been content with having the gospel reside in a particular location in society. They have bent over backwards to make sure that the gospel is understood and appropriated by the humble and the poor and the outsider. And how can one cavil with that? That is, in contrast to European Christianity, where you had staid Orthodox churches and from which common people for a century have been alienated, in this culture, you have people who, in fact, work among the middle workers, who work among urban blacks. And these movements are largely evangelical. So that's, I think, the first strength. That's was one of the things that I found very interesting in the book that I chose, the book that I wrote on democratization, is to see how many common people in the early republic who had been completely alienated from the life of the church found in these new forms of faith a way to claim the gospel as their own. Secondly, these kinds of evangelical faith typically expose pretense and foster openness and vulnerability. That is, they say that religious experience is for all people. They have typically railed at smugness, at religious snobbery, and forms of Christianity embodied in upper-class culture. They have said that Christianity means that we take off our masks, that common people should be able to express themselves. So there has been this deep sense of community that always doesn't happen, and most religious groups, starting one way, soon become respectable. But if you read about the early Methodists in England or early American Methodism and the kind of love feasts and the sort of class meetings, these were places typically which cut against the class structure of society and where people took off their masks and talked about life in this unpretentious way. Thirdly, this whole tradition has been very tremendously strong at popular education and popular literature. Richard Hofstadter called American evangelicals in the early 19th century anti-intellectual. And I disagree with that. I don't think they were anti-intellectual. What they said is that intellectual matters should not be the preserve of some elite. They should be open to all. And so, from the Methodists on, the evangelical tradition has been very good at publishing pamphlets and books accessible to regular folk. And if you look today at the power of the sort of evangelical press, the power of publishers like Word and Zondervan and Herdman's and Multnomah and Moody and on and on. I mean, you look, this is a multi-million dollar industry. That is, I mean, the typical Christian bookstore that you go in today, it's filled with these how-to manuals designed for common people. It's a whole tradition of that. And that can be a problem, but it's also an asset. Educating common people. The evangelical tradition has also been good at formal educational institutions, that is, cutting in people who other people weren't educating. In the 20th century, fundamentalists and Pentecostals have started over 100 Bible colleges, for instance. designed to educate people who normally wouldn't receive Christian education. So that's the third strength. The fourth is the innovative and adaptive characteristic. That is, these are groups which are not stayed and given to do things the way they've always been done. And when you see the kind of special purpose Christian ministries that come out of this tradition, for instance, if you look at foreign missions today, that is, the Christian witness of Americans in other countries, if you look at any statistics, the dominant force there today is done by independent foreign missions. It's missions not related to any one church. I mean, they're associated generally with independent churches, with Baptist churches, and so forth. But they're independent missions that have risen up. If you look at campus ministries, if you look at something like Campus Crusade for Christ or InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, these have been major forces on American campuses over the last 20 years in terms of trying to reach students with the gospel. I've mentioned publishing firms and magazines already. Radio and television. And this probably should not be mentioned as a strength in the contemporary climate. But it's interesting to look back. This is not something new. If you look back into the 20s, it was fundamentalists and Pentecostals who largely went to the airwaves. That is, the mainline churches didn't so much. I realize yours is an exception. I can remember as a boy, in our home, we listened to the Lutheran Hour. But there have been a number of intriguing studies recently of local radio broadcasts in the 20s, religious broadcasts, and it's dominated by fundamentalists and Pentecostals. In fact, the first woman to hold a radio license in this country was Amy Semple McPherson in Los Angeles, the Pentecostal leader. But also all kinds of segmented groups, professional groups for doctors, lawyers, businessmen, the military, a group like the Navigators. The evangelicals are very adept at doing things like that, are huge Bible study organizations. Something like Bible Study Fellowship that was operating in South Bend. It operates in hundreds of communities across this country. Or young people's organizations like Young Life or Youth for Christ. These unecclesiastical organizations, special purpose. Now, Robert Wuthnow, who is a distinguished sociologist of religion at Princeton, and also, I'm happy to say, a really fine Christian person, he has a very important book called The Restructuring of American Religion Since World War II. And in that, he suggests that as our society becomes more fragmented, as people have less loyalty to political parties, less loyalty to denominations, that in fact it's these special purpose kinds of organizations which in fact have greater potential. In a sense, they're peculiarly modern. They're in step with the way our society is moving. Now, in many ways, that movement, I think we can say, is not a healthy one, but it's the way it is. And these kinds of special purpose movements are effective in reaching people in that society. Let me turn then to the liabilities of this tradition. The first, I think, has to do with the issue of the objectivity of salvation. One causality has been that Reformation convictions about the objectivity of salvation, particularly with the great revivalist concern for the experience of conversion at a particular point in time, it has been difficult to retain the 16th century emphasis on God's action. The evangelical tendency in America has been to preserve the importance of preaching, Bible reading, the ordinances, many evangelicals not even calling them sacraments, and Christian fellowship, but to interpret these as occasions for a human act of appropriation, that God saves in baptism, that God gives himself in the supper, that God announces his word through the sermon, that God is the best interpreter of his written word, All these are Reformation convictions modified in America by the stress on human capacity. This is a point that Harold Sinkfile makes with great effect, I think. Secondly, it has to do with the church. If a great evangelical strength is the activistic power of its voluntary society, so also a weakness is the voluntary conception of ecclesiastical organization. Evangelicals might find a spiritual truth in Luther's claim that outside the church there is no truth, no Christ, no salvation. But the prevailing tendency is to treat all ecclesiastical organizations as products of human creativity, as objects of human manipulation. Americans achieved great success in shaping the political institutions of the New World. Tom Paine appeared to be correct when he said of the American experiment, "We have the power to begin the world over again." This confidence in the ability to new model institutions has spilled over into the church. Creativity, flexibility, marketability, and adaptability result, but so does a certain loss of permanence, stability, and tradition. And that's the third weakness, I think, has to do with just that tradition. So much of evangelical life is rootless and freshly minted. New congregations, new patterns of worship, new leaders, new organizations. Few evangelicals stand in a religious tradition which provides ballast and long-term orientation. Few experience a Christianity that is grand, majestic, deep, and profound. That is, there is no theological, ecclesiastical center to keep this movement from being consumed by popular culture. And just as I think the danger for mainline churches has always been that it tacks too much with high culture, and its intellectual life is corrupted by the direction of high culture, so I think the danger of evangelicals is that they're co-opted by that which is taking place in popular culture. The final weakness has to do with intellectual life. For all the success at popular level, evangelicals have failed notably in sustaining serious intellectual life. Part of the reason is institutional. This movement is so atomistic that there are few institutions capable of having anything like a serious, certainly not a serious university. There's some serious colleges, but it's too atomistic and too short-lived to set up institutions which have serious intellectual life. Thus, evangelical thought, once profound, is often now dull, rusty, banal. And we find that evangelicals who decry secular humanism have little ability to deal with secular humanism in high culture, in the universities, in the arts, in the media. All that they can decry secular humanism by marching in the street, but that's about it. In conclusion, then, let me say, evangelicals, I think, have pushed to an extreme the three cardinal planks of the Reformation. I mean, in one sense, I think you can explain evangelicals by saying it's the Reformation factored through the lens of democracy. That is, they've taken the idea of the Bible alone, and they've just pushed it further. And since the Reformers, when they said the Bible alone, that they, in some sense, they used it in different ways. When they were speaking against the Catholics, they would say, let the Bible speak for itself. But if Luther was speaking against the sectarians, he did not want every Tom, Dick, and Harry reading the Bible. American evangelicals have said, you know, Alexander Campbell said, Protestant clergy are just like Roman clergy, and the people should have the Bible for themselves. Similarly with the idea of faith. Luther knew that faith had to be something that was appropriated by people. And towards that end, he translated the Bible into German. Towards that end, he wrote music and tracts that people could appropriate. That faith was not something formal and just associated with the church. It had to be appropriated. And I think evangelicals have taken this and said, yes, faith has to be appropriated by all people. Similarly, with the priesthood of all believers, the Reformers took one step away from the sort of sacramental, priestly nature of the church. And so many evangelical groups have just taken that a step further. And it's interesting that in America, many of these groups are deeply religious and deeply anti-clerical at the same time. Usually in Europe, anti-clericalism is secular. In America, you have deeply Christian people who are also anti-clerical. The cardinal doctrines of the Reformation were put forth against the medieval church that kept people at arm's length from the mysteries of God. To examine church institutions and evaluate their effectiveness in enabling people to live out the gospel should be the ongoing task of Reformation churches. No church order or liturgy or singing or culture is normative if it does not make the gospel alive for the faithful. The evangelical impulse, so vibrant in America, can be a good catalyst for all of you in evaluating how well your church is achieving the original impulse of Luther, which was to make the gospel rather than the church the benchmark of all that we do. At the same time, your traditions offer sanity in a world of dizzying fads, theological integrity amidst catch-as-catch-can versions of the gospel, and most importantly, a God-centered and grace-centered depiction of spiritual reality in the face of self-centered piety. I think the real issue is whether the young people in your churches and the new people who walk through your doors can grasp and make their own the gospel of grace which your liturgy so powerfully conveys, but to which modern people may have difficulty relating. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to take some questions, if that's your pleasure.
Well, as usual, thanks for the work in the series. Can the audience hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to burden you, sir, with the burdens of the current Missouri Synod. Nevertheless, this also might apply to your context as well. It kind of seems to me that what's going on now is that we're concerned about the evangelicals, and they somewhat with us. You're our main speaker today, for instance. You talked about the ignorance on the one hand and avoidance on the other of history. And you know, we talk as if we are in a bottle, and as though Roman Catholicism, Orthodoxy, never existed. And what's going on in the former Soviet Union is a great example of that, the evangelicals and everybody else is running over there and treating the Orthodox as though they're heathens and pagans. Now, as far as I'm concerned, as a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor, emeritus, I think it's, if, as it seems to be, at least from David Lukey's book, that the Missouri Synod somehow wasn't able to continue on her own standards and convictions, that we had to see if we can't get other insights from other Christian groups, and if this be the evangelicals, so be it. But at the same time, why didn't we send one of our pastors to a Roman Catholic seminary? So we can have some of their insights, too. send another pastor to the Orthodox Seminary, have some of their insights too. Why is this smorgasbord so incredibly limited?
Yeah, I think I agree. I almost said in jest to begin with that in addition to being an evangelical and a churchly Protestant, I spend most of my waking hours in a Catholic institution and identify pretty strongly with that. But I was afraid I'd be seen as a three-legged monster. So I agree. I think for all its problems with our traditions breaking down and people not looking for the orientation to what their tradition was, and I know this is a tremendous problem in the Christian Reformed Church now. A generation ago, people were formed in that tradition, they stayed with it, and they revered it, and it's just becoming assimilated. I'm sure the same, I don't know the Missouri Synod well, but I'm sure the same thing is happening. But there is a positive kind of ecumenicity. And I'm not talking about the ecumenical movement, but I think the barriers between denominations are so much lower today, and that can be a helpful thing. For instance, in South Bend, we have a minister, a Christian Reformed minister, who is a wonderful preacher, but he is so eclectic. I mean, we are much more liturgical than Christian Reformed churches normally are. I mean, he partakes of Catholic, Episcopalian. I mean, that is, I think we are in a situation today where we can partake of the strengths of other traditions. And I don't mean towards moving to some bland or liberal kind of direction. So it can, I think it can be a negative, but I think it also can be an extremely... And I think if Orthodox faith is going to be maintained in the modern world, and that's certainly my goal, then I think we do have to strengthen it from whatever sources we can find. And in that sense, I think Orthodox, Roman Catholic, whatever, we need to gain sustenance from them as well.
Seems the social theory of the circulation of elites and the percolation of ideas from on top and into it. Would you respond to that, please?
Yes, I think that may be more true in modern America, but I think I think historians of the early republic are increasingly taken with the role of popular culture in the wake of the American Revolution in defining their own norms. I mean, the coming of Jacksonian democracy, in some sense you could see it as a manipulation of elites, but it was a different kind of elite. That is, it wasn't, Andrew Jackson was not someone who was Harvard trained. He was a soldier who identified with the people and on that basis came to power. Similarly in these churches, I'm not saying that Francis Asbury or Alexander Campbell or Charles Finney weren't elites, and certain of the movements that they formed were highly undemocratic, but the whole basis of their authority had to do with their constant appeal, democratic appeal. I mean, democracy always has that tension. That is, as urban areas in America became more democratic, you had the rise of political bosses who were sort of anything but democratic, but their appeal was to the people. I don't know if that's helpful. But
Luther's study is not my field of scholarship, but it seemed to me as you gave us the strengths and weaknesses, that originally Martin Luther's work had all of the strengths and had all the opposite of the weaknesses that you listed. And I wonder, as a historian, when do you see sort of a loss of that dialectical tension? That now we would sort of link Lutherans with the more ossified side rather than with the vibrancy of reaching a popular culture. And do you see both a loss of that dialectical tension in the original Lutheran Reformation in Europe, or do you see it in the bringing over to the American culture, or do you see that the dialectical tension hasn't been lost?
Yeah, that's a very hard question. But I do think those traditions which came out of the Reformation, students mean they have never been very good at transcending class barriers. I mean, if you take Scots Presbyterians, if you take Episcopalians, if you take Norwegian Lutherans, if you take New England Calvinists, in a sense, sociologically, they've been largely middle-class kinds of cultures, which have never been very good at really getting down and dealing with the kind of class distinctions that have emerged in the last 150 years. I mean, there are some exceptions to that, but in some sense, it's the complicatedness of history, the strength of having serious theology and intellectual life. At the same time, sometimes can imprison us to a certain kind of faith that someone who is not intellectually inclined, which repels them. So I think it's one reason that in the end, I think that America has been blessed because it has so many different kinds of churches. And that's why David Martin said America has prospered here, because you have churches that appeal to the elite. And then you have churches that grow out of people right at the bottom of society.
Then I have to ask a follow-up. Does that doom us to only minister to a certain level of people?
No, I don't think that would be the calling of any denomination. But, I mean, I have to say, I face this in our local congregation in South Bend. Tends to be largely middle class, or actually probably too many university professors for the good of the congregation. it's hard, and I think but I think churches have to work at that. I mean, and we talk about that. Hopefully, when a person who is not educated comes into that church, they're not put off by our demeanor and by the forms of liturgy and the kind of preaching which we have.
Dr. Nash, you speak about the democratization of the church, and while you're doing that, you talk of high culture and lower culture. Isn't that a very undemocratic dichotomy to use and difficult to use, because isn't it part of the democratization of that goes on in our country that high culture doesn't belong to anybody but everybody? Do you follow what I mean? So that a trained clergy, for instance, in this particular case, literate sermons, music which is as complicated as Bach, that doesn't belong to anybody high up, that belongs to the people. Would you comment on that?
Well, it certainly does. I like to listen to Bach chorales, but I dare say if you went to Gary, Indiana, and you took a cross-section of people that work in those steel mills and asked them if that turned them on, I doubt if it would. I just read a very interesting paper by a Jesuit priest who dealing with the inroads of Pentecostals among Hispanic Catholics. And his conclusion was that the mainline forms of liturgy in the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, he was dealing with the extent to which they have so little appeal to most Hispanic people. And some of it has to do with forms of music, forms of community. And he was basically criticizing the church as being sort of ossified in a middle-class way, and that forms of liturgy that deal with Hispanic people by and large have to change, or, in fact, the inroads of Pentecostalism would continue.
Kind of a two-part question. First of all, personal observation, personal experience, I am the result of a Pentecostal tongue-speaking, foot-washing heritage, and I found my way to evangelical Lutheranism in the Missouri Synod and was surprised to find no less than four of my classmates from Evangel College showing up here at one time or another. I was wondering if you could speak to the counter-movement to evangelicalism, which is, I should say, the popular evangelicalism, which is to the traditional gospel-informed evangelicalism, which you find in places like Concordia Seminary. Secondly, I was wondering if you might be able to speak to, I was appreciating your comments, but I was wondering if you might be able to speak to the distinction between Calvin's idea of church, in which has inevitably informed the American experience, especially in the American evangelical experience, which has been democratized, atomized, individualized, and Luther's definition of church as a Gemeinde, community, which is informed by the gospel, whereas in some respect I think Calvin really saw the church informing the gospel, Luther saw the gospel informing and creating church. And I was wondering if you could speak to the dichotomy between those sources of our concept of church today here. Thank you.
Yeah, let me try to say something about those. I think these evangelical traditions, I think there are a lot of people that come, that go through them and then find stability in more stable traditions. I think there's a whole pattern of that. Over sometimes people that are converted in these traditions are in some sort of special purpose movement, then end up in mainline kind of churches. Sometimes it's a generational thing. You know, I know someone who teaches at North Park Seminary, you know, who began as a oneness Pentecostal. Those kinds of things aren't, I mean, Grant Wacker, a good friend who's been at Chapel Hill and now will be teaching at Duke Divinity School, you know, comes out of the Assemblies of God. I mean, this is not at all typical. I saw that a lot when I graduated Wheaton College. People who come out of fundamentalism, who are starved for any kind of liturgical presence, so many, a number of them become Episcopalians. So I think that's typical. I don't know, on the distinctions between Calvinist and Lutheran notions of the church, I guess I'll pass on that, except to say I don't think the overall shape of the church in America, I don't think has been overwhelmingly Calvinist. I think both that tradition and the Lutheran tradition have been overwhelmed by much more powerful historical currents. That is, the traditional New England church, the New England standing order, I mean, that's been blown away by these kind of democratic traditions that I've tried to describe.
Okay, at this time we need a break so that you have a few minutes to find the room where the sectionals are held. Let us thank Dr. Hatch.